You're listening to Radio 720, WGN Chicago. What's going on? Welcome back to Extension 720. Again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
Our guest tonight on this second half of Extension 720 is something of a surprise. We did not announce this in advance. There's been no advance publicity, and as soon as I say the name of our guest, you will understand why. Salman Rushdie is our guest, a distinguished and very significant writer who, of course, in recent years has carried a very special burden, namely the hit order put out by the Ayatollah Khomeini some years ago. The new novel by Salman Rushdie, which has been critically acclaimed and is indeed a rich experience for anyone who plunges into it, is The Moor's Last Sigh. That's just published by Pantheon. You said some years ago, indeed, to a reporter, I presume, for a British newspaper, yes, for The Independent. You said in February of 1990, quote, "I make no complaint. I am a writer. I do not accept my condition. I will strive to change it. But I inhabit it. I am trying to learn from it." The condition to which you refer there is the fatwa that was pronounced against you by the Ayatollah Khomeini just a few months before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that statement is almost 5 years ago. Does it still represent your reconciliation or your attitude towards your very special situation?
Yeah, and broadly speaking, yes. I mean, I think it's important for writers to try and internalize, you know, what happens to them and then somehow transform it into work. And I think that's certainly something I would hope that I was doing. I think, ironically, the strange thing is that the longer this thing goes on, the harder it is to stand. You know, one doesn't get used to it. You get the opposite of used to it. You get more and more sick of it. And I think if it had gone on being the same, it would have been completely intolerable. But I think the reason the reason you find me here in reasonable health and condition is that it hasn't remained the same, and that we've spent a lot of this time pushing back against this threat. And to an extent, anyway, succeeding in getting it to recede.
Well, you've tried to get all sorts of politicians and higher politicians, i.e. statesmen, to do something about it and to bring pressure on the government of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
The Ayatollah of sainted memory has gone to his reward,
yes.
Such as it may be, but the government that he left behind him still seem to insist that they want to maintain this death order that they placed upon you, though at times they've suggested perhaps they're reconsidering.
Yeah, I mean, actually, one of the few reasons for believing in the afterlife is the pleasure of thinking of where the Ayatollah Khomeini may now be. But they've been speaking, as is usual with the Iranians, with two voices. On the one hand, as you correctly say, they have declined to cancel Khomeini's fatwa. On the other hand, for the last 12 months almost now, they have been repeatedly and with increasing emphasis saying that they consider this to be ancient history and that they do not consider it to be incumbent on them to carry it out and that they have no intention of doing so. I mean, in a very strange way, they're even trying to use Khomeini's words to prove that he never meant it to be carried out. And one of the Iranian leaders was heard saying in an interview that he remembered talking to Khomeini the day after the fatwa, and he remembered Khomeini saying that there was no need to carry it out. Another leader, I think even the president, Rafsanjani, has stated that he knows perfectly well that if Khomeini had ever meant the fatwa to be carried out, then he would have given instructions for the dispatch of assassins, and that since he did not ever give such instructions, he meant it to be only a rhetorical flourish.
But as I understand it, there have been a number of occasions when the British Secret Service have come up with evidence that assassins had been dispatched
to the UK. Yes, that's quite true. That's quite true. It just goes to show that you can't believe the Iranians. But the interesting thing now is that it seems that the Iranians' economic and position may be so weak that the penny's dropped and that they have understood that if they're going to get anybody to help them at all, they need to change, to moderate their actions. And I mean, to put it simply, if they want help from Britain and from the European community, they have to stop threatening to kill the citizens of those countries.
It occurred to me, reading this entrancing new novel, The Moor's Last Sigh, that the Moor, who suffers from that strange disease in which he ages at a double rate, so that at 30 he's got the face and the body of a person of 60, that in a way he represents you. You're getting an earlier taste of something which ultimately comes with later age.
Yeah,
we all live with the shadow of mortality, and once you cross, say, the barrier of the age of 60, it's sort of omnipresent as something that you know will sooner or later come down upon you. At the age of 30, one isn't terribly aware of all of that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm about 150 years old, actually, yeah. at the present time, so he's a lot younger than me.
Mm.
But other than that, we're very alike. I think clearly the fact that I've had to seriously consider the possibility that there may be less time than I was expecting is one of the places from which that idea of accelerating his life comes. But it comes from a number of other places, I mean, not all of which have to do with me. I do think that there is something in the air these days. There's a general feeling of the acceleration of the times, you know, the general feeling that the rate of history, the pace of change, has accelerated. That things metamorphose now at a dizzying speed, and that people feel a kind of panic about that, about life running away with them. You know, I thought that this image, the image of somebody whose life really was running away with him, it would be a way of simply making literal, if you like, that metaphor, and that it would echo something which people feel about their own lives.
Religion, and organized religion, and religion turning political or turning insistent in, as it presumes to also take over the power of nation, religion seems to be a deep interest of yours, in some sense a preoccupation of yours. And of course it shows in this book, which among other things outlines a kind of rampant Hindu nationalism which you view with alarm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, if you write about a country like India, where religions are so multifarious and so passionately adhered to, then quite simply you have to make your own reckoning with it. You know, it would be impossible really to describe the reality of India without doing that. And I mean, I always was struck by an extraordinary statistic some years ago. A mad Indian anthropologist made an effort to enumerate the gods of India. Because these, of course, there's not only the great Hindu pantheon, but this comes right down to a kind of animism, you know, tree spirits, river spirits, and so on. And he made this heroic and, of course, doomed effort to enumerate all these gods. And the figure he came up with, which he said was only sort of rough ballpark figure, was 300 million. Now, the country has a population of 900 million. That means there's, you know, one god for every three people at the moment.
Seems rather well rationed.
Yes, if you extrapolate that backwards, however, you know, when I was a kid, when I was sort of eight in India, like 40 years ago, the figure that I was taught for the population of India at that point is 450 million. So the population's doubled. Doubled in the last 40 years.
So gods are getting thin on the ground.
Well, you see, but if you think about it, presumably the divine population remained reasonably static, mm-hmm. you know, gods being not inclined to multiply. So if you project backwards, there must have been a period, maybe only 50 or 60 years ago, when there were actually more gods than people in India. Now, if you live in a country where the divine population actually outnumbers the human population, well, you have to take some notice of that.
That's just a variant of a paradox that you encounter if you simply play with genealogies. You had two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents. If you just do a multiplication by two factorial back to, say, the year, counting four generations per century, back some 500 years, you find that you had more ancestors than just about as many ancestors as there were people on the earth. If you go another five or six generations backwards, you've got far more ancestors than ever existed at that time mm-hmm. on the earth.
Yes, well, there are a lot of ghosts around. This is one of the problems of life.
But coming back to religion, of course, religion got you into trouble with the last book, The Satanic Verses. The reason the Ayatollah got so angry is that you were supposedly defaming or blaspheming the Islamic faith, and more particularly the image of or the character of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
You are yourself of Muslim, of Islamic background,
of,
are you not?
Of crudely Islamic background. I was fortunate in having not very religious parents.
Yeah.
It was the kind of religion where you would go to church on Christmas Day kind of thing. It was very casually observed. Just about the only Muslim thing I can remember happening in our house is that we didn't eat pigs.
Yeah.
But I mean, just to go, you know, about that question about the satanic verses. You see, the strange thing is about Islam that, unlike Christianity, it does not believe its prophet to be a god. You know,
he's merely the last of the prophets.
He's the messenger, and Muhammad himself, in his lifetime, was very insistent on the fact that he should not be worshipped.
Yes.
One of the reasons why he didn't like the idea of there being images of him is that he feared that if there were images, people would worship the images. So it is rather ironic that this man, who went to such trouble to insist on his own humanity and to reject the idea, to say that the Christians made a mistake about their prophet by turning him into a god, should now be deified.
Have you ever been able, have you had the opportunity to engage in reasonable discourse with intelligent, intellectual, that is, Muslim theologians?
Well, you see, the fact is I'm not very interested in theologians because I'm a fiction writer.
And yes.
But I have, of course, had many encounters during this period with Muslim intellectuals.
Well, I mean particularly during this period.
Yeah, yes. No, I have had with Muslim intellectuals and writers and poets and thinkers, you know, from many countries.
Yes.
I mean, for instance, about 3 years ago there was an event in London, in Cambridge in England, organized by a British arts organization, which included delegates from many Arab and Muslim countries, both writers and professors and critics and so on.
And you did one of your unannounced drop-ins, did you?
Yes, I did an unannounced drop-by, yes. And I was very interested to know what would happen, and I'm, to be truthful, slightly apprehensive. I mean, not for my safety, but that I feared there might be people who would wish to tear a strip off me and so on. As it turned out, the delegates who were there from Muslim countries were the most delighted to meet me, the most appreciative of what I'd written, of course the most knowledgeable about it too. And what I've never forgotten is that there was a very distinguished Saudi Arabian journalist and critic who insisted on coming over to shake my hand at the end of the session, and he said that he wished to do this because, as he put it, you, Mr. Rushdie, are a free man. And he spoke very good English. He understood fully the nuances of what he was saying. But I think that I get letters more or less every week from Muslim readers around the world, which all say, don't imagine we're not all on your side.
What's the larger story, or the larger modern phenomenon to which your particular burden belongs? It's something about the individual artist in relation to the forces of political power.
Yes, I think there is. That is, of course, an old and continuing story.
It is indeed.
It's a story which one could trace back to Ovid. I mean, I've been reading the Metamorphoses just now.
Yes, Ovid was exiled from Rome.
From Rome for the rest of his life.
For being sacrilegious.
Yeah, and never got home. And so that's a long way back. But I do think that continues to be a problem. People of great power do seem to mistrust, above all else, the individual voice. You know, and the book is, of all the forms of art, the most individual. That's to say, unlike a play or a movie or a television program or a radio show, all of which involve the collaboration of many people to make it happen, you know, a book is one guy sitting in a room saying what he thinks. And there are people who just can't stand that.
Only within the last few months, a significant poet was killed by the government of Nigeria.
Indeed.
And who's the writer in the Sudan who was...
Yes, indeed. I've lost the name just now, but you're right. It's not just in the Sudan. We find, apart from Ken Saro-Wiwa being killed by the Nigerian government, his colleague, the Nigerian Nobel Prize winner, Wole Soyinka, has been forced into exile. Turkey's greatest living writer and their biggest Nobel Prize candidate, Yasha Kemal, is currently facing legal action from his own government because he has dared to point to the mistreatment of the Kurdish people. In China, we have, you know, more or less open season on writers at the moment. In Algeria, their greatest writer of the present period, Tahar Jaout, was shot by the Islamic fundamentalists recently, and he's one of about 25 or 30 journalists and writers who have been targeted by fanatics. So, yeah, it's a very hard time to try and maintain that simple important thing of being able to say what you think, even if the government disagrees.
You've been interested in the possibility of political action, or rather getting some states more or less democratic in orientation to bring pressure on Iran, in your case, and more broadly, to work towards some kind of new international compact which frees the writer or protects the writer. Is there any hope that political instrumentalities can achieve any transformation of the endangered situation of the writer in some parts of the world?
Well, truthfully, I'm not that optimistic about it, because I think actually the degree of cynicism of publicly appointed or elected officials is increasing rather than decreasing. It seems to me that the willingness to put human rights high on the agenda when considering one's relationship with another country is decreasing rather than increasing. And so, no, I don't think there's that much hope that the united forces of the free world will combine in that way. So what I've been involved in is trying to do some things that writers can do themselves. And an organization that was set up now 3 years ago in France called the International Parliament of Writers, inflated name, but nevertheless a good organization, invited me to be its president. And the function of this organization is specifically to find ways of helping out persecuted writers. And one of the ways in which we've done this is to set up a network of what is so far, I think, about 25, and which we hope to expand to about 100 cities. And these cities agree to name themselves as cities of refuge. And what is meant by that is that they will agree to give, as it were, a home to a persecuted writer and his family, and a kind of stipend out of city funds. And the writer would be nominated by this writer's organization. So it's a way, at least, of finding safe haven for people who desperately need it. And this scheme has already resulted in a Bangladeshi writer being accommodated in Berlin, and an Algerian writer and his family being accommodated elsewhere in Europe. And so that seemed like a practical way of putting back, for me personally, to try and put back some of the enormous attention that was paid to me.
Yeah. A certain indulgence in voyeurism is inevitable when one has the opportunity, as I have now, and I'm much welcome to talk with you. That voyeurism comes down to the question, to parody Trollope's title, The Way We Live Now. How do you live now?
Oh, much better, thank you. I mean, that's to say...
But what's the daily round like?
At the moment, it involves doing newspaper interviews.
Yes, but when you're back in England?
When I'm back home, well, I mean, broadly speaking, at the level of private life, I have regained the ability to lead most of what you would consider to be an ordinary private life in terms of, you know, coming and going as I choose.
But you have guards sort of omnipresent in your life.
Unfortunately, there is still that need for protection, yes.
Yeah.
And that's why, in my view, we're about, you know, 75 or 80% of the way back, but not all the way. And until we can get this firm assurance that there won't be, as it were, hit squads on the way, you know, then I think there might be a continuing need for some caution.
You have to worry about something else, don't you? Not only officially appointed hit squads delegated to come and try to execute the fatwa, but eccentrics and madmen who are religiously inspired or otherwise, or maybe merely soldiers of fortune, they think they are, and they want to collect the bounty.
Yes, well, all I can say is that in these, while that's true, and that does require a continuing need for caution, I suspect the problem is less in reality than it is in the popular mind. And the fact is that in these 7 years, we have had absolutely no evidence of such individual or freelance activity, so to speak. That the evidence that there has been directly connected to the government of Iran.
A part of this rather dreadful story, however, is that though happily you've been spared, and I imagine you've been spared because you've been well protected, a few others who've been associated with the Satanic Verses have been killed or significant or seriously injured.
Yes, one of the Japanese translator was killed, and the Italian translator of the novel and the Norwegian publisher of the novel were injured and happily made full recoveries.
So they are out there.
They certainly have been out there.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to know this, because I think there's a tendency for some people to think that because I wasn't killed, it meant there was nobody trying to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the truth is that the fatwa has been carried out in those three instances.
What sort of bug did Germaine Greer get in her ear? Why is she critical of you for your role in all of this?
Germaine is, you know, is a permanent member of the out-of-step army. You know, so
she tends to be professionally disgruntled. I know
yes,
that.
She does. I mean, I think if everybody Germain knows thinks A, Germain will think B.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid it was just that kind of problem. And I'm sad about that because...
What was the nature of her complaint?
Oh, just that I was a megalomaniac, I think, and that I had insulted the oppressed people of the world so they would rise up against me.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, on the subject of megalomania, I mean, nobody is better qualified to speak than Germain. It's a shame because Germain, of all the people who I would have considered to be my friends or my friendly acquaintances, really, is, I think, the only one who did not come through for me. You know, everyone else did. And actually, it was one of the most heartening aspects of this, that my friends were so strong in their determination to stand beside me and help me.
Yeah. Noteworthy among them, Martin Amos, who's been very steadfast and
indeed,
very important to you.
Martin is a very good buddy of mine. Right here in America, the list of writers who stood up for me was I mean, endless, really. And some of them were my friends, Paul Auster or Susan Sontag, etc. And many of them were writers I'd never met. You know, I would not have got through this thing alone. You know, one of the reasons I've got through this is because not just the literary community, but the bookselling community, who had to be on the front line of this thing, stood up and made sure that the book was preserved in publication and in distribution. So I think, you know, we haven't reached the end of the story. The fatwa is not cancelled, but it seems to me we can take this moment as some kind of a turning of a page. That's to say, here's a new novel. This was an attempt to silence a writer. By the publication of The Moor's Last Sigh, it's possible to demonstrate that the writer was not silenced.
Yes, but strangely, there's a kind of repetition compulsion in operation here. The government of India has unofficially banned your new novel.
Yeah, they're sort of currently blocking it. They're being extraordinarily foolish because the book has been wonderfully well received in India, the copies we did get in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it is, I must say, it's always been particularly important for me that my books are well received in India. I mean, it matters to me, and particularly with this novel, which is the first large-scale novel mainly dedicated to India that I've written in 15 years, I mean, since Midnight's Children 15 years ago. And so I really wanted to be sure that people over there would accept it and respond to it in the same way that they responded to Midnight's Children. And the fact that they did meant a great deal to me, and the frustration, therefore, of being unable to get books in there when the country is dying to read it, it is very great. But there are various steps that can be taken, which are being taken. For instance, we are questioning the matter in the courts, and there is... The Indian law courts actually have a good record at not permitting this kind of nonsense.
Well, what's their complaint, and who, in fact, voiced the complaint? It has to do with your representation of a Hindu fundamentalist nationalism.
Yes, so it's ironic that, given that this is election year in India, that this government will presumably be spending a great deal of the next several months abusing the Hindu fundamentalists, and, in my view, quite rightly, pointing out that they are a fantastic danger to the future of democracy in India, and that's to say trying to defeat them electorally by all means.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather extraordinary that a book in which I have said, in a rather milder, comic and fictional way, the same thing, should become the subject of this kind of blockade. The Indian government and I, on this point, agree. So it's a kind of craven piece of giving in to the faintest piece of fundamentalist pressure. I mean, they hardly said anything. And it will, I mean, I get the feeling, and there's a bit of unofficial evidence to suggest, that the Indian government would actually quite like the law courts to unblock the book, because then they're off the hook.
Is there really a significant Indian Hindu fundamentalist political leader named Bal Thackeray?
Yes, there is indeed.
He's represented in your book, according to interpretations by those who know the Indian political situation better than I do, by the character
What?
Ramon Fielding.
Ramon Fielding.
Yes. Well, the thing they have a couple of things in common. That's true. First of all, they are both described as operating in the city of Bombay, which Thackeray does. Secondly, obviously there's a kind of ing-lit joke in calling a character Fielding,
course,
when there's
yeah.
a real life one called Thackeray.
Did Thackeray come by his name legitimately as an Anglo?
No, it's actually a transliteration of a perfectly reasonable Marathi name, Thackeray. it just so happens to sound like an English name. There's the other thing they have in common is that they both the fictional and the real character began their careers as political cartoonists.
Yes,
and it just occurs to me to mention that somebody who's done that should be well acquainted with satire, but I guess it's different mm-hmm. when it's aimed at you. And they're both what one could modestly call fascist thugs. There's that too, and proud of it. You know, because if you were to ask a member of Bal Thackeray's party if he considers himself to be a fascist, he would say yes, he did. So that's true. To that extent, he's right. There is an attempt to portray and satirize such a character. But he's not the only person on whom I based my character. And a simple explanation of this is when in my novel Midnight's Children I had certain satirical intentions towards Mrs. Gandhi, I had in that novel a character called Indira Gandhi. And if in this novel I had had those intentions towards Mr. Thackeray pure and simple, then I'd simply have had a character called Bal Thackeray. The fact that he's not called Bal Thackeray is owing to the fact that he's based on many other people.
He's a compound,
too. He's a compound.
Himself, yeah.
In fact, there's a kind of comic device in the novel in which he's presented as looking like a gigantic frog. I mean, he's a kind of Jabba the Hutt figure. Mm. And the reason for this is that I was once in India making a documentary for television and met a different Indian fundamentalist leader who had on his desk a telephone in the shape of a green frog, which struck me as being absurd, especially since it would croak instead of ringing and he would speak into it. And I remembered the frog, which I didn't in the end use in the documentary. And in the end, that frog, the telephone, ends up on the desk of my fictional character, who also then looks like a frog. So,
interesting.
So I'm afraid Mr. Thackeray can't lay claim to that part of the character.
The frog has universal comic significance or allegorical significance.
It does. Frogs
in France, Milou Le Grenouille is a figure of...
Exactly. Frogs are funny. What can I tell
you? We pause for an overdue commercial stop, and then we must plunge into the novel, The Moor's Last Sigh, and at least talk about some of the characters and talk about the background from which they are drawn, and perhaps read a passage or two. We return directly to Salman Rushdie after we pause for these words.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Now, back to Milt Rosenberg.
We return to conversation with Salman Rushdie, author of The Moor's Last Sigh. That is the new novel just published in this country. This is being recorded on the day of his visit to Chicago, but I should hastily add that by the time it is played on this very night, you will be elsewhere in the country.
That's right. Well, it is a kind of really a real whistle-stop tour, this. I wish it were slower. I've never been to Chicago before. I'd enjoy being here a bit longer, but there we are.
You have been touring not merely in this country, but earlier, was it on this book as well, in Australia?
Yep. Yeah, the book came out in England in September.
Yeah.
And since then, I've really been fully employed in its service. I think there's a strange thing that happens nowadays that first you write the book and then you become its servant. And so but on the other hand, it's been so long since I could do that simple thing, the book tour, that I thought that this time I would really enjoy doing it, partly for itself, partly just for the pleasure of talking about the work and mm-hmm. introducing it to people, and partly because it was also a way of saying, you know, that I was back in business.
Well, let's talk about the work, and indeed let's talk about the great clan who are the focus of the work. It's, in a way, a family history or a family romance
mm-hmm.
or a family epic. The Dagama Zagoibi family. How do you say Zagoibi?
Just like that.
Just like that. Mm. Now, they are Dagama is, of course, a Portuguese name, and the Portuguese were early in the colonial period in India. They established a foundation in Goa.
That's right.
And the And they're still around. Dinesh D'Souza, an American writer on political topics, is from India. And
would
I imagine
of Portuguese going descent.
I've never asked him. I imagine he's from, of Portuguese going descent. Mm. And Zagoibi would be a Jewish name. And
That's right.
The big Jewish colony, also historically quite old, is in Cochin.
That's right. That's now one of the reasons for writing this book is that this is the most ancient Jewish colony in India. Really, it is 2,000 years old. And
they're known as the Bnei Israel, I think, which
is the sons
of Israel.
And now they're virtually extinct, because what happened after the formation of the State of Israel was that more or less the whole younger generation went to Israel. So what is left now is a tiny rump of kind of the elder generation with no children. And it is, I have been to that part of India, the Cochin, which is on the bottom left of India, several times, and was very struck by the poignancy of the story of this ancient history coming to an end, focused around this very beautiful synagogue, tiled in blue tiles imported from China.
I've seen pictures of it, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's rather lovely.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember going to the synagogue in the early 80s and meeting there a completely South Indian-looking man, a Keralan-looking man, who was called Jackie Cohen, and who was the keeper of the synagogue. And I remember asking him and learning from him my first things about the history of this community. And I said to him, look, Mr. Cohen, could I come back tomorrow and we could talk a bit more depth about this? And he said, why? And I said, well, you know, I mean, just humor me, you know, I'm a writer, and maybe I'll write something one day. He said, there is nothing to write. We already have a leaflet, which he then gave me. But he did relent in the end and talk to me some more. And so I had always borne in mind the idea that maybe I would write something about this community, because of its poignancy.
Now, this family, the Dagama Zagoibi family, are very big in Bombay, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
They are very, very rich. They control the spice trade.
Mm-hmm.
They are engaged in all sorts of illegitimate activities. And they're both a criminal syndicate, after a while, and a great commercial house. And our hero, the central figure in the book, the one who ties it together, is Maurice Zagoibi. Maurice, thus he is known as the Moor, this man who is... So what's the name of that disease that ails you so quickly?
I'm just blanking. I knew you were going to ask me, and I can't remember. but it's...
But it's a real disease.
It is a real disease, which gives a kind of legitimacy to the conceit of aging too fast.
The conceit of aging in double time.
Yes.
And he... And lots of critics have pointed this out, is also imprisoned and exiled, exiled to Spain, in fact, for offense that he has given of a political nature.
That's right. Well, it's as you can see, it's a kind of simple and non-complicated plot. But it's true that he falls from grace, if you like. And one of the things that I wanted this novel to do was to dive through the layers of Indian society, and then move outside it to look back at it from outside.
From Andalusia.
Yes. And the novel, after all, is much about the layerings of the world. It's about paintings being painted over other paintings and then searched for.
Yes, it is indeed a palimpsestic novel, just as in a crucial moment in the novel, a painting done by some lesser artist of the Moor's mother, who's a great artist, displeases her, and it is painted, and he paints it over with
his
own
image. That's right.
So layers upon layers upon layers is what we have in the novel. It's what we have in one crucial incident with regard to the art of painting itself.
Exactly, and even the world of the book, I felt, should contain those layers. You know, so that I went to some trouble to construct, if you like, an overworld and an underworld in this book, and the narrator begins in this overworld, which is also, if you like, the world of his mother. Who the great artist, as you mentioned, who is brilliant, a kind of bird of paradise figure. She's loquacious, she's domineering, she's irresistible.
And she is the dawn.
And she is the dawn. She's
Aurora.
Called Aurora.
Yeah.
And she's and around her there swirls this very, I hope, bright and comic and sensual world. And then at one point, for various reasons, he's expelled from his family, by her, in fact, and plunges down through the layers, if you like, and ends up not just in the gutter, but in something I've always been very fascinated by, which is the Bombay criminal underworld. Because there are mafias. I mean, actually, this is obviously the town to talk about mafias.
Where are there not?
there are mafias in Bombay of great surrealism, and he finds himself engaged in that world, and then later flees the country and is, as you say, imprisoned elsewhere. And then the final part, movement of the novel, looks back at his life from that vantage point outside. Now, there are obviously some very straightforward connections there with my own vantage point outside and so on. And I don't deny that, like any writer, I think a point of view character does in some way represent your own point of view, but only to a certain extent, you know, and in the way that Joyce's Stephen Dedalus is not Joyce, in the way that Proust's Marcel is not Proust, even though they share a first name, you know, even though Augie Marsh is not Bellow, although no doubt they have plenty in common as regards their early circumstances.
I never knew Marcel Proust. I do know Saul Bellow, and I would say that the similarity between the two isn't all that
great.
Remarkable.
No, well, I think that, you know, I actually think Moses Herzog is not Saul Bellow either. You know,
it's closer.
Yes, closer, and nor is Charlie Citrine. You know, but writers do make shadows of themselves. You know, they make kind of phantoms of themselves, whom they can inhabit with some of their ideas and some of their feelings.
Your writing has sometimes been compared to Marquez, sometimes to Borges. Your writing is rich in incident, and is and it has kind of a magical realist explosiveness about it at times, all of which makes for great fun, quite apart from the other virtues.
Well, I'm very pleased you said so, because one of the great delights for me, and actually especially, if you like, after all the darkness and turbulence that surrounded the Satanic Verses, is to have a novel to which people have reacted with such pleasure and with such sense of having fun from it.
There are superb comic, not merely passages, but superb comic incidents woven through the novel. And indeed, I'd like you to read a portion of the novel, just a page or two, and I've asked you to go to one which is rather a wonderfully surreal and comic tale.
Yes, this is a moment at which the narrator's maternal grandfather, Kamush Dagama, is flirting with communism.
Back in the early 1920s,
and he's found out about a strange scheme involving getting actors to play the part of Lenin. It was Grandfather Kamush who found out about the fake Ulyanovs. In late 1923, in Fort...
They do sound like an acrobatic team, don't they?
Yes, the dancing Ulyanovs. Yes. In late 1923, he informed his wife and their friends that an elite group of Soviet actors had been given exclusive rights to the role of Lenin, not only in specially prepared touring productions, which told the Soviet people about their glorious revolution, but also at the many functions the leader was unable to be present at owing to the pressures on his time. The actors would memorize and then deliver the speeches of the great man, and when they appeared in full makeup and costume, people shouted, cheered, bowed, and quaked as if they were in the presence of the real thing. And now, Kamush excitedly stated, applications from foreign language actors are being solicited. We can have our personal Lenins right here, properly accredited, speaking Malayalam or Tulu or Kannada or any damn thing we please. My grandfather became increasingly obsessed with this question of counterfeit Lenins. With what zeal he scoured the locality to discover men with the necessary acting skill, memory capacity, and interest in his plan. With what dedication he worked, getting copies of the latest statements of the illustrious leaders, finding translators, and so on, and rehearsing his little troop of seven, whom Belle, his wife, with her customary brutality, had dubbed the too tall Lenin, the too short Lenin, the too fat Lenin, the too skinny Lenin, the too lame Lenin, the too bald Lenin, and Lenin the toothless. Kamush corresponded feverishly with contacts in Moscow, cajoling and persuading. And finally, in the hot season of 1924, he had his reward. There arrived in Cochin a genuine card-carrying member of the special Lenin troop, a Lenin first class, with the power to approve and instruct the members of the troop's new Cochin branch. He came by ship from Bombay, and when he walked down the gangway in character, there were little gasps and shrieks from the dockside, to which he responded with a series of magnanimous bows and waves. "How may I address you?" asked Kamosh, blushing politely as he met his guest, who was traveling with an interpreter. "No formality, comrade," said the interpreter. "No honorifics. A simple Vladimir Ilyich will suffice." A crowd had gathered, and now, out of the arrival shed, came the seven local Lenins in their beards. They stood shuffling their feet on the dockside, grinning sweetly at their Soviet colleague, who burst, however, into long fusillades of Russian. "Vladimir Ilyich asks, what is the meaning of this outrage?" the interpreter told Kamosh as the crowd enlarged. "These persons have blackness of skin, and their features are not his. Too tall, too short, too fat, too skinny, too lame, too bald, and that one has no teeth." "I was informed," said Kamosh unhappily, "that we were permitted to adapt the leader's image to local needs." More barrages of Russian. "Vladimir Ilyich opines that this is not adaptation, but satirical caricature," the interpreter said. "See, two beards at least are improperly affixed in spite of the admonishing presence of the proletariat. Under no circumstances do you have authority to proceed." Kamosh's face fell, and seeing him on the point of tears, his actors leapt forward. Eager to demonstrate the care with which they had learned their roles, they began to strike attitudes and declaim. In Malayalam, Kannada, Tulu, Konkani, Tamil, Telugu, and English, they proclaimed the revolution. They demanded the immediate departure of the revanchist poodles of colonialism, the blood-sucking cockroaches of imperialism, to be followed by the common ownership of assets and the annual overfulfillment of rice quotas. But the crowd, little by little at first, and then in a great swelling tide, began to guffaw. Vladimir Ilyich turned purple. Leninist vituperations issued from his mouth and hung in the air above his head in Cyrillic script. Then, spinning on his heel, he stalked back up the gangway and disappeared below decks.
It's wonderfully invented. But where does it come from, in fact?
Well, the thing about the actors in the Soviet Union being accredited to play Lenin is true.
Yeah.
That's to say, it was true that because it was felt that Lenin couldn't get around enough, they had to have people to impersonate Lenin and wander around and perform his role. They did memorize his speeches and go around and deliver them. That part's true. The part about Kerala, of course, is not true. But where it came from is that I was once in Kerala, where there is a very large, and continuing to this day, very large and healthy Marxist party. And I saw painted on a wall a painting of Lenin in the characteristic posture of sort of striding towards the future, mm-hmm. and a big speech bubble coming out of his mouth, full of Malayalam script.
Yeah.
And I suddenly thought, oh, this is strange. Here Lenin speaks Malayalam. And at some point, this added up in my mind to the notion of these Lenin actors, and the scene came out of that.
Is it possible that you have written pseudonymously under a name similar to yours, and indeed won the National Book Prize? Are you possibly Norman Rush?
No, but he reviewed my book.
I know.
So I'd better not be Norman Rush.
But that would be a wonderful caper if
yes, I know. I remember
Norman Rush reviewing your own book written as Salman Rushdie.
Well, if you ever see me reviewing his book, then the suspicion would be legitimate.
But the reason I ask, of course, is that review in the New York Times only recently is very enthusiastic, very informative, is a very intelligently written
mm-hmm.
review, I thought.
Yes.
But he ends with one caveat, something that bothers him, and that is the character, the representation of Abraham Zagoibi, the patriarch
Ooh.
Of the family. He says, well, let me read just a bit from that review. Zagoibi, the patriarch, is represented as a kind of Jewish Professor Moriarty, of subcontinental crime, a controller of Muslim gangs, a drug kingpin, a plotter involved in creating the Islamic bomb, a procurer of little girls. His Jewishness is repeatedly referred to, even though he's not observant and has in the past been blocked in an attempt to convert to Christianity. Maybe this piece of portraiture could have been painted less hyperbolically, in cognizance of the paranoid mythologies of secret Jewish power so widely current. At the very last paragraph, so, another brave and dazzling fable from Salman Rushdie, one that meets the test of civic usefulness, broadly conceived, as certainly as it fulfilled the requirements of true art. No retort to tyranny could be more eloquent.
Well, he's very nice.
He's ambivalent.
Yeah, well, I mean, he certainly didn't. He has this point about, I mean, I would just say, come off it, Norman. You know, this is a book in which that there's a very large Jewish community extremely touchingly and sympathetically portrayed, I hope. The fact that there's one character in the book who is a crook only, I mean, only, it's only because that's the necessities of the story, you know, and it would be a poor day if all Jewish characters in literature had to be nice guys.
Seemingly, though, it points up something which is both part of the charm and the special force of your artistic temperament, and also a source of some of the trouble you inevitably get yourself into.
Mm-hmm.
You do not compromise, you do not deal in euphemism, you do not, you tell it in the American argo, you tell it like it is.
Well, I hope so. I mean, what else is there to do? You know, and I think I've always remembered the great line that Graham Greene used to use, was fond of, where in which he said, "Our interests on the dangerous edge of things." Yeah, and I do think that that is as good a definition of literature as I can think of. You know, literature is what you find on the dangerous edge of things.
There is a quotation that's been around for years. Some earlier people who used it, namely especially the American refugee political scientist Hans Morgenthau, used to use it a great deal. Title one of his books with this, and he always attributed this quotation to the Old Testament, to the prophets, one of the prophets of the Old Testament. A simple injunction: speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, it wasn't said by Jeremiah or Isaiah. I once had occasion to trace it, and after about 6 months, I found it at its source. It's from an otherwise rather obscure Quaker sermon of the 17th century. But still, the injunction, speak truth to power, is very...
Yes, it's very, very well said.
Very well said, very directly said. Would you like to adopt that as your crest?
I mean, certainly, I think it's something that writers do. And I think...
Should do.
Well, you know, what should, you know, I think that every writer has to find their own path, you know, I wouldn't prescribe. But I find that one of the things that's happening in our age is that as politicians understand the power of information, the power of the information media, to shape, if you like, truth to their particular needs and whims, power has become more and more and more interested in deforming the truth to serve its own needs.
Well, in the authoritarian regimes, of course, they've mobilized and hemmed in writers, graphic artists and so on, and mm-hmm. had them turn out, quote, Nazi art or socialist realism or
yes.
whatever you call it.
Yes, but I think it's not even just in totalitarian regimes. You know, I think if we look at the way in which power manipulates truth at moments when it feels it needs to, such as, for instance, wartime, you know, what happened in Desert Storm, for instance, what happened in the Falklands War, you find great deformations of truth which serve the interests of power. And I think... I've always felt that there is a paradoxical situation these days when so much of the world of power seeks to tell us lies. It becomes the function of the writer who's admitting he's telling you lies, because he's calling his work a work of fiction, to try and tell you the truth.
Live long and prosper, sir.
Thank you.
I imagine that's your plan.
That is certainly the plan.
It's been a great pleasure and indeed a boon to have you visit with us. The new novel by Salman Rushdie, The Moor's Last Sigh, is just recently published in this country by Pantheon. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.